This is a special edition of The Pen and the Yad. It's a conversation on racism with Rabbi Michael Siegel from Anshe Emet Synagogue in Chicago and author Jonathan Eig, talking about Dr. King and George Floyd.
It's nice to talk to you. I haven't seen you in a long time, but it's great to hear your voice.
I caught a glimpse of you at the prayer rally, but I didn't get to say hello, and I felt bad about that. I was trying to social distance and be a part of that march at the same time, which was not an easy thing to do.
Not with 10,000 people marching through Bronzeville. That was true, but it was quite an experience, don't you think?
It was. It felt great to be... I feel good right now to be in any kind of a community physically, but it felt especially good to be out in response to something as important as this.
That plus the fact that it was peaceful, that the police were very, very supportive and had been contacted in advance, and that there was just this, I thought, a remarkably positive feeling in the air considering what else has been going around the country.
That's right. And I think it's worth noting that the overwhelming majority of these marches have been peaceful, and they're really disconnected almost entirely from the acts of robbery and looting that have taken place. We should celebrate the great spirit in which most people have taken to the streets, I think.
The vast majority, that's for sure. Although I have to say that it was striking as we walked to hear Pastor Harris point out this grocery store, this Walgreens, all sort of boarded up. And the challenge of getting food at a time like this is striking.
Yeah, I heard people saying the same thing on the walk. People who lived in those neighborhoods were concerned that those stores might not open again, given all of the economic issues going on and the uncertainty about COVID-19. You know, in our neighborhood, there are defaults, but in those neighborhoods, there are not many defaults. And economic crisis alone, never mind what's going on with police brutality and racism, it's all of one piece, and it's making for a lot of challenges.
I'm happy to say that since March, the Mariano's has reopened, but... The larger problem right now is that many people who have been caught up in the economic downturn, and that's certainly a very high percentage in that area, don't have money to buy food. And so the problems are compounding at this time in the wake of this pandemic. And it's a scary time, but it's also a clarifying time, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the beating of and the murder of George Floyd might not have triggered this intense reaction if COVID and the recession hadn't already highlighted the vast inequalities in this country, as if the murder of Floyd was the straw that broke the camel's back. But this had been building for a long, long time. The police brutality had been building. The fact that COVID is hitting disproportionately in African-American communities and in poor communities, the economic difficulties are hitting disproportionately. And all of that comes together when you look at what's behind this moment in our history.
I think that's so true. In a way, the boat has already been rocked, and the disparity is so plain that people are ready to speak out. And I think that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you really want to get big picture about it, you could say that this has been a problem throughout, built in, baked into our country's history. The only country in the modern world that was built with slavery, that had slavery in its DNA from the moment the nation was born, and that we have never really lived up to our promise of equal justice under the law, that it was never really true. And now, to borrow Malcolm X's phrase, the chickens have come home to roost. Finally, maybe this is what forces us to start to deal with that.
I think that's a wonderful point and a chilling one. And we were talking not long ago about a book that was published a few years back called Stamp from the Beginning, which is a book that I think both of us would recommend because of what it does so well is that it goes through the history of racism. And he begins with Aristotle. When we get to this country, it's just so clear that at every step of the building of this country, there is also this conversation going on about people of color that from the very start. And I think it's a really important book to read. And I think we need to come to terms with that at long last as a country. And I think he does it very well.
Yeah. And if we actually do the work and start to come to terms with it, maybe we'll look back at this as a turning point and not just this horrifying, dark moment that we're seeing at present. Unfortunately, this country's had moments of reckoning before when we thought that we were going to finally deal with our racist, unjust system, and we haven't come through. We didn't get the job done. The 50s and 60s certainly were a moment when it appeared that we might finally be reckoning with these inequalities, and we fell short. Our schools are actually in many ways more segregated now than they were before Brown versus Board of Education. Our communities, our cities, our suburbs are in some ways more segregated than they were in the 50s and 60s. So the job didn't get done. And Dr. King knew it, talked about it at the end of his life, that he hadn't moved the ball forward as much as he thought he would have.
This must be so fascinating for you, living this moment while writing a book about Dr. King's life.
It's weird. And it's, in some ways, it's really good for me to be dealing with these issues because it informs everything that I'm writing. It helps me to see Dr. King's life in a different way, through a different kind of a lens, because it's not just history. You know, we're living it. He tried to fight the exact same fight that people that are marching in the streets for today. He never wanted to be the leader of this movement. It was sort of thrown into his lap, and he was brave enough to accept that responsibility. But he really believed that his generation was going to be the generation that ended racism, ended segregation, ended discrimination. And he built a movement of Americans, millions of them, who believed that along with him and went to work. And you see this moment of opportunity, and then you see it fall apart by the late 60s. You see that it's crumbling and that we are falling back into our old habits. It's heartbreaking, really. But I think the fact that King tried, the fact that King did so much and took that responsibility upon himself is inspiring, and it moves me today, and to think that maybe we can try again.
Or continue the work.
At the very least, continue the work. That's a given. That's a must. That's not even an option.
I mean, one of the things that you've taught me since you've started this work is that the Dr. King that I know, the Dr. King who I gave the I Have a Dream speech, the pacifist Dr. King, I imagine being shocked by the lack of progress. But one of the things that I've learned from you is that at the end of Dr. King's life, he was despairing, and that he probably wouldn't be all that surprised that we are still dealing with voting issues in states like Georgia that are hardest, they're hitting hardest in areas of people of color. And on the list goes. But maybe that Dr. King, the one who was assassinated, he would not have been so surprised by all this.
Yeah. And if you think about just the fact that he was assassinated, that America has assassinated some of these great figures who stood poised to try to force genuine change, to try to force radical change. We couldn't handle them. They were assassinated. What does that say about our commitment to this institutionalized racism? It's horrifying, really. And you mentioned the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech. If you ask people what they know about that speech, there are going to be two lines. They're going to remember, I have a dream, and they're going to remember mm-hmm. the content of our character, right? Those are the two lines that people remember. But what they don't know is that that was a March on Washington for jobs and justice. Jobs came first. And King used most of that speech to insist that reparations had to be paid, that until America came to terms with the injustice, with the fact that the country had been built on slavery, until it made an effort to pay amends, to atone for its sins, to admit that it was wrong, and to compensate the ancestors of the enslaved in some way, I mean, to the descendants of the slaves in some ways, that there would be no moving on. You cannot move. And we talk about this in Judaism all the time. This is something you've taught me. You can't move on without a proper apology. Can't atone for your sins if you don't really understand your sins and try to make amends, right?
I couldn't agree with you more about that. And certainly the tradition would undergird that idea. But one of the things I learned in Kendi's book, Stand from the Beginning, was that it's not the attitude that, though we should be concerned, it's the policy. In other words, the policy drives the attitude as opposed to the attitude driving the policy. And so many of the policies of our country then and now stack the deck against people of color. And unless we're willing to engage in a broad conversation about how we're going to change the board, how do we give people opportunities? How do we build businesses? How do we create a different educational system? And in this post-COVID-19 downturn, it's going to be that much more complicated and that much harder. And are people who are reaping the benefits of the system, not that they're not working hard, not that they're not studying hard, but they are benefiting from it, are they willing to look at the system and rethink the policy. The policies to broaden the reach to those who may not be benefiting today.
And this is where it gets difficult. Are people willing to sacrifice? Are they willing to give up some of what they've got? Are they willing to pay higher taxes for better schools? Are they willing to create something, to create a true democracy, if they have to give up something themselves? And when it calls for that personal sacrifice, that's where we get into trouble. And you see it over and over. The wealth that was created during slavery was never, the people who owned the slaves were not prepared to share when slavery ended. They were not prepared to share their land. We granted land to white people who agreed to move west so that we could populate the West, but we never offered anything to the people who had been enslaved. So at some point, you have to do more than talk. You have to actually commit to policy changes and to sacrifice.
Well, actually, we did promise. We promised 40 acres and a mule, which a lot of people received, but not those of color. And that, I think, is that's part of the whole issue of reparations that I think we're going to have to revisit and think about. There's no question about that. You know, I was on a panel last night with two pastors and another rabbi, and one of the pastors looked at me and he said, "Rabbi, why are you marching? Why are you involved?" And one of the things that I said was that I am not involved because of our history. I think that that leads us astray. You know, so often you hear that, oh, we were slaves and you're slaves, and so we need to address that. I have no idea what slavery feels like. And my pain as a Jew in Jewish history through anti-Semitism and my fears are very different than a person of color. And so I don't think it's helpful for us to compare histories or have what I would call a pain Olympics to see who's had a more difficult or challenging life. Rather, I am involved because my tradition, the Torah itself, obligates me to act. You know, ours is a tradition that tells us we have to leave the corners of the field, that we have to take care of the poor, that we can't walk by the blood of our brother. We have to be involved. And so that obligation to not only act, but to see every person as if they are created in the image of God, that is what moves me. I'm interested to know how you respond to that.
I feel that's really important. If you look back to why I became interested in these issues as a kid, I think it goes back to Hebrew school. I think it goes back to the lesson, not that you're just supposed to do mitzvot. Everybody teaches you, you know, you should be a good person, even if you're not religious. But our religion teaches you that we are all fashioned in the image of God. And if we're all fashioned in the image of God, that doesn't extend just to the Jews. It certainly doesn't extend just to the people with pale skin. It has to extend to everybody, or else it's meaningless. The whole position is meaningless if it only applies to a select group. So if the religion means anything to you, you have to embrace that piece of it. And I think that that's true for so many religions. They teach the same thing, that God commands us to love one another.
You know, Christians will say, what would Jesus do? For us, the question isn't whether I observe the Torah, but whether or not the Torah is lived through me. Am I living a life that expresses the best values of Torah? That's a struggle. It's not every day. But that sense that this is my responsibility in the world, to live for something beyond myself, for ideals that raise me, that's the real issue. You know, there's a debate amongst the rabbis. Should I do a mitzvah if I don't understand it, and therefore wait till I understand in order to do it? Do I follow the law in order to understand? And I would suggest that in our society, we need laws that will raise us up, that will create a society that will impact the way that we look at the world. What I think we've shown in the last few hundred years is that it doesn't come to us naturally, that people are going to make decisions based upon their own needs. We need something to lift us up, don't you think, Jonathan?
I do. And I think, you know, Dr. King talked about how important the law was too. And he was mocked for it by some of his more radical critics, I should say. You know, they called him the Lord, the Lord, because he was so high and mighty. But he truly felt like that was the role of government. We have a government to unite us. And that responsibility of the government means that they have to uplift us. They have to come up with laws that push us to be better people. And without that leadership, without the government, it's almost impossible to forge meaningful change in certainly in any kind of a short time span.
Isn't it amazing that the Ten Commandments begin, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt? So the very first statement is A, that there is something above you, and that this entity, this being, cares about injustice, cares about slavery, and took you out of slavery. That is, to me, a message that speaks to us loud and clear today.
Right. So if the very first commandment reminds us that God took us out of slavery, that ought to remind us that we need to stress freedom, the importance of freedom. And you can't have freedom as long as you have two different classes of citizenship.
Right. But freedom isn't enough. And I'm going to push this a little bit, because it's not just that I believe in freedom. What it has to be, I think, is an obligation to something higher. Even if it doesn't work for me in this moment, even if I'm putting myself at some sort of risk, I still have to do it because it's my obligation. You see what I'm trying to say? Because otherwise we fall back. It's hard to make these decisions. The reckoning for our country is going to be serious. And it's going to really upend things and make it much more challenging. But I think it has to be done.
Yeah, that it's going to cost us something, that we each have to be willing to sacrifice something to build a better community. That's really hard. Everybody wants it to be someone else making that sacrifice. Yeah. And I think, again, to get back to it, unless the government compels it, people are going to have to be dragged a little bit in that way.
Right. I mean, it's of interest to us that the Bible starts out the story of Cain and Abel. And when God comes to him, comes to Cain and says, where's your brother Abel? After Abel murdered him, he says, am I my brother's keeper? That's at the very beginning of the Torah. I think that you could argue that the whole rest of the Torah is the answer to that question. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. We'll end here. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Rabbi.